Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ADA Update, 20th Anniversary of the ADA Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance from an operator, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's call, Robin Jones. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon and good morning to everyone that is participating today, and happy anniversary as we are within days of recognizing and celebrating the 20th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I know many of you are hosting or have already hosted celebrations in your own communities or will be participating in activities at your local, state, or national level for the anniversary, and I hope all of those go well. Just to give a little update on what we're technology-wise and what's happening today before I turn it over to our speakers, please be mindful of the fact we have individuals that are on the telephone. We have individuals who are using streaming audio on the Internet, and we have individuals who are using streaming captioning on the Internet as well. So a multitude of ways and methods. The session is being recorded. We will have a recording as well as a edited transcript posted onto the archival page of our website at www.ada-audio.org within 10 business days following the end of this session if you wish to refer others or yourself would like to review what actually occurred during this particular session. The ADA Audio Conference Series is brought to you by the ADA National Network, which is comprised of the 10 regional ADA centers, which are funded by the U.S. Department of Education, National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research. As you heard, our session today is related to the anniversary and our update. This is an annual session that we hold each year, and you can go back to all of our archival sessions over the years, and Sharon and John have been gracious enough to join us during all that time, and I don't know if that really means that they've been around forever or not, but I guess that's a good thing for both of them, and we're happy to have them. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speakers, both of them, today. I'm going to then turn over the microphone to John Wodach, who will begin out our discussion today with the updates of the Department of Justice, followed by Sharon Rennert from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and then we'll open it up to all of you for questions. So save your questions, write them down, think about what you want to say or ask as we go, and then you'll have plenty of an opportunity to pose those questions to both John and Sharon. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading either of their bios. They are available on our website, and you can link to those from the website. But John Wodach is the chief of the Disability Rights Section for the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. He's been a civil rights attorney for over 30 years and worked with the federal government specializing in the rights of persons with disabilities. He's been actively involved in the enforcement of Title I as it relates to employment in governmental entities, so actually employment under Title II and Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Law Act. He also has a key role in developing administrative policy on the ADA, and he's the author of the Justice Department's ADA regulations, as well as the implementing regulations for Section 504 of the Rehab Act. Sharon Rennert is a senior attorney advisor in the Americans with Disabilities Act Division, Office of Legal Counsel within the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She's a senior member of the EEOC's ADA staff, and that's not by age. That's by the time period that she's been with them, joining the division in 1992, shortly not too long after the ADA. She served for a little while as the acting director of the ADA division, and she's been actively involved in developing the commission's policy interpretations on a variety of different issues. She is an instrumental in providing technical assistance to the 10 regional ADA centers across the country and is a key resource for all of us as we respond to many of your questions when you stump us or when you pose the difficult ones to us on our technical assistance lines, as does John's staff in his division as well. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them so that they can spend the rest of our time actually giving us an update on what's happening and what they're doing in their respective agencies. So go ahead, John.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, and good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to some of you. I'm delighted to be with you again, especially as we are really in the middle of our celebrations of the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I thought in the time today I would just go over some of the activities that we've been doing at the department for the past year. It's been a whirlwind of a year. There's a recommitment to the vigorous enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act at Justice, and we've had really quite a robust program for the past year. I thought I'd go over a couple issues with you in this time and then try and save a lot of the time for answering questions. We'll start with the regulations because I'm always asked about that first. I think you all realize we are in the middle of it, or I'm hoping at the end of a process that we started in 2004 to update the regulations implementing Title II and Title III. Those of you that follow this closely will know that the Office of Management and Budget has the regulations for review. Their review period ends on July 25th, so we're hopeful that by that time we will have more announcements for you on it. We are working, I can tell you, around the clock to try and complete the department's action on it. Part of what happens in this period of time is that all federal agencies get a chance to review them and give us their comments, and then we edit and change them based on those comments, and that's the process we're in right now. You should know that we also, having gone through this process, decided that the department should really issue some specific regulations in a couple areas. And if you watch ADA.gov over the next couple days, I'm hoping there'll be some announcements on those. We're looking into preparing what we call advance notices of proposed rulemaking, which are really rules that go out that ask a lot of questions that begin the process of development of new rules. And the issues we are considering are accessibility of websites under Title II and III, captioning and video description of movies, accessible equipment and furniture, including medical equipment, and the fourth one is how state and local 911 call centers should address really the new generations of communication technology that is being developed. If you, I can do a little ad. If you have a computer and have some time between 10 and 12:30 on Friday Eastern Daylight Time, we will be having an ADA anniversary event at the Department of Justice, and I hope there'll be some announcements on some of these issues at that point. Okay. Some new issues. I think you're aware of one of the new priorities for us is dealing with accessibility in the digital age. And on June 30th, Justice, together with the Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights, put out a joint letter to colleges and universities basically expressing concern over the university's use of electronic book readers that are not accessible. And the letter solicited assistance of the university leadership in ensuring that emerging technologies used in education are fully accessible to individuals with disabilities. This letter really follows on a series of settlement agreements that we entered into with colleges and universities that were using the Kindle DX, which is, in our view, an inaccessible electronic book reader. They were using it in classrooms as part of a pilot study with Amazon.com. Under the agreements, the universities agreed not to purchase, require, or recommend the use of the Kindle DX or any other dedicated electronic book reader unless and until that device was fully accessible to individuals who are blind or have low vision. These agreements are on our website if you're interested in them. They were with Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio, Pace University in New York, New York, Reed College in Portland, Oregon, Princeton University in New Jersey, and Arizona State University. Another major initiative for us has been implementing fully the decision in the Supreme Court decision in 1999 in Olmstead. I think most of you realize that that establishes the principle that people with disabilities must be offered the opportunity to receive services in their communities when it's appropriate, and that it really is an independent violation of law to unnecessarily segregate people from society. At the heart, Olmstead is really about choice and independence, giving people with disabilities the opportunity to live in their communities, to make their own decisions, to shape their own lives. I think the Justice Department and other federal agencies for the past 10 years have been criticized for not effectively enforcing Olmstead. And last year, the president marked Olmstead's 10th anniversary by proclaiming in an executive order, "This is the year of community living." We've taken to heart the guidance there and the sort of direction, and we have made enforcing the integration mandate of the ADA one of our biggest priorities. In the past year or so, we've participated in 18 lawsuits across the country. I'm not going to go through them all today. They're on our website. We've been involved with lawsuits against the states of Georgia and Arkansas and New York. We're in other lawsuits against the states of Connecticut and a series of them in Illinois. These are all challenging the failure to provide community-based services, which in our view forces people with disabilities to live in institutions rather than in their communities with the right supports. We've also supported challenges by private entities in North Carolina and California to alter the way these states administer their services so that people who are now living in the community won't, after changes, particularly because of the financial situation of states, won't face the risk of institutionalization. We filed, later today there'll be a press release on our website, we filed a case yesterday in California, and we filed one on Friday in Illinois. Both of those were joining cases that are ongoing. The California one is Napper versus the County of Sacramento, and it really discusses the plan proposed by the county to decrease the availability of necessary mental health outpatient services, which would, in our view, put people at risk of institutional placement. And in Illinois, the case was Hampi versus Hamos, and there we were supporting the plaintiff's motion for class certification, dealing with a group of young adults with severe disabilities who have aged out of the Medicaid program, and they're in danger of not getting those services unless they're institutionalized. We had an agreement last week. Our barrier work continues to be sort of the bread and butter of what we do, and there was a fairly major agreement. It was a consent decree that we did last week with Quick Trip Corporation, which is a private company that owns and operates more than 550 gas stations, convenience stores, travel centers, and truck stops in mostly in the Midwest, the South, and sort of Southwest. We got into the case because we had complaints about inaccessible parking by a couple of individuals in the Omaha, Nebraska area. And it took us a while, but we worked out through long negotiations with Quick Trip a very comprehensive consent decree. It's, again, on our website. It's been accepted by the judge. It requires a variety of changes from Quick Trip. They're going to make necessary modifications at their current stores over a three-year period to make changes to the stores themselves to make them accessible, and they've agreed to design and construct future stores so that they'll be accessible. At each of their current stores and fueling positions, they are going to ensure that at least two fueling positions are accessible, meaning that the fuel dispenser controls, self-payment, the self-service payment mechanism, call button, and amenities are in an accessible position. and they're going to adopt a policy and train store employees on policies to assist in not only fueling for people who want to get gas, but also providing assistance to people in their stores, including admission of service animals, maintaining accessible features, having parking in the right place, that sort of stuff. They're also going to make their website accessible, and they're going to pay a maximum civil penalty of $55,000. And the last item in this, which is sort of new for us in the ADA arena, but it's been used in the housing area, we are creating a compensatory damages fund. And $1.5 million has been put into this, and we are going to begin a process. There'll be notice on it through ADA.gov, by which people who feel they have been discriminated against by Quick Trip can send us their stories, and we will see if they are entitled to compensatory damages in relief. The fund, it's an interesting fund because if we don't spend all, I mean, if not enough people come forward to use up all $1.5 million, the remaining funds will be distributed to nonprofit organizations that serve the interests of people with disabilities in those states. Earlier, and you probably are aware of this, so I won't go into it too much, we did a lawsuit and consent decree against the city of Jackson and the Jackson Public Transportation System. I'll just mention it to you because if you're interested in the provision of city bus services and how to provide accessible paratransit services, this consent decree lays out a very detailed set of compliance activities, and I think it's useful as a blueprint for how to make bus and paratransit service accessible. It's available on our website. There's a lot of information about it. Similarly, I'll be brief about we have a comprehensive agreement with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Massachusetts. It's a research and teaching hospital that's affiliated with Harvard. It's a pretty big place. It's got more than 30 buildings. It includes over 200-bed acute care facility, a trauma center, three community health clinics, and some very high-level specialties. The agreement requires that each of their clinical services will make 10% of their patient rooms, including their toilet facilities, accessible. Their whole series of architectural barriers are going to remove. But one reason I think it's an important agreement is it deals with the purchase of accessible medical equipment, including medical exam tables, radiologic and diagnostic equipment, accessible patient beds, and the placement of lifts. I think it's useful in that regard. And in that regard, I'd like to point out, I think some of you have seen, we have on our website a new technical assistance document that's been there since May that deals with the provision of, it's called Access to Medical Care for Individuals with Mobility Disabilities. We are going to be reissuing that, I hope, as an ADA anniversary event, together with the Department of Health and Human Services, and we're going to make it a joint document from both of our agencies to try and get more information out about the obligation to provide accessible medical equipment. Another area where we still get a lot of complaints are service animals. And the denial of service animals in various places. I'll mention two things we've done recently. One was announced yesterday. It was an agreement, a nationwide agreement with Blockbuster that has more than 3,000 retail stores, at least right now it has them, across the United States. And this was brought up by a complaint about a person with a service animal who wasn't allowed to use the store, and it's a fairly typical agreement for us. It and implements a comprehensive nationwide non-discrimination policy about service animals, requires the entity to distribute the policy and train their employees on the rights of service animal users. It requires them to provide the same kind of training for new staff when they come on. They have to post their service animal policy and post a service animals welcome sign in each of their stores. They're creating a toll-free ADA complaint line, a grievance procedure, paying $12,000 in damages to the individual who filed the complaint, and a $10,000 civil penalty. The other matter is an interesting one, and involves a lawsuit that we started against a lawyer and his law firm. The case is U.S. versus La Julier. It's on our website as well. In that case, the law firm barred a woman, her husband, and her attorney from entering the law office for a deposition because the woman was accompanied by her service animal, which was a dog, and the woman herself is a veterinarian. She has traumatic brain injury and other conditions that affect mobility and balance, so she used the service animal for those conditions, and she had individually trained her service animal to provide disability-related assistance. That was resolved by a consent decree. Again, they're going to adopt an ADA-compliant service animal policy, post it in the conspicuous location, post the service animal's welcome sign. They have a process for training staff, undergoing training and providing training and reporting allegations. In addition, they're paying $30,000 to the complainant in damages, and in because of associational discrimination, $10,000 to her husband and a $10,000 civil penalty. Let me just a couple of things. We tend to, it's not very well known, but we spend a lot of our time doing work with prisons. We get a lot of prisoner complaints. We tend to resolve them at the micro level, but occasionally issues become larger. And we filed a brief in a case in Georgia called Miller versus Smith. And it's just, I'm mentioning it to you. It's on our website. It's interesting. It's a case against the Georgia State Prison and the Augusta State Medical Prison, two correctional facilities in Georgia. The allegation is that the person with a disability was routinely excluded from a variety of programs and benefits. Our brief really is interesting because it's sort of a primer on the obligations of a prison system to people with disabilities. And so it's useful in that regard. It addresses the wide range of issues that prisons are dealing with, especially as right now in the correctional context, because these jails have custody of individuals with disabilities. They have to deal with a whole range of issues, from failing to provide critical health care and personal services, whether it's access to mammographies, necessary consumable medical supplies, whether it's colostomy bags, catheters, the provision of durable medical equipment, and personal assistance services, assistance in eating and dressing, the whole range of issues, which a lot of our prisons are not used to thinking of themselves as that is their job. And so we're spending a lot of time on that issue as well. I'll just quickly do two more things and then turn this over to Sharon. One is a case I've talked to you about before. In our view, it's been a difficult case. It's an HIV case that took place in Alabama involving a family that was going to Wales West, which is a resort for families with RVs. It's near the Alabama's Gulf of Mexico beaches. It's a very large facility. It has lake, nature trails, and a steam-powered narrow-gauge train. The lawsuit stemmed because the family that had booked a four-week stay there for a summer vacation, and they wanted to be there because their father was commuting to nearby Mobile to continue his ongoing cancer treatments. They were there with their two-year-old child who had HIV, and during the course of the day, the mother, when they were checking in, mentioned casually that they were there because the child had HIV and the father had been having cancer treatments, and this was their chance to be together and have some family time. But later that day, the manager appeared and told the parents that the child could not use the swimming pool or the showers because of the child's HIV. The family was very upset. They eventually checked out. We filed the lawsuit that went on longer than I thought it should have, but it finally resolved itself. they've adopted all the appropriate policies and have agreed to pay the family $36,000 in damages and $10,000 in a civil penalty. And last, you know, we're not always associated with doing employment work, but in the area of state and local government employment practices, the EEOC receives the complaints, negotiates them, attempts to achieve voluntary compliance, and if they can't conciliate a case, will refer it to us for action. A lot of the cases that we take, we settle short of filing a lawsuit, and because of the way the law is written, we don't make those public. But if we do file a lawsuit, they are being made public, and we've recently finished a case against Ventura County involving a social services program. The allegation was a person who is a social services worker who is deaf applied for a position, and she requested reasonable accommodations. At the time she applied for the position, she had been employed doing the same job in Los Angeles for more than 8 years, had great references, clearly was qualified for the position. Ventura really took the position that they didn't have an obligation to provide interpretive services for her. We litigated the case and have since settled it, and Ventura County has agreed that they will train their supervisory personnel in hiring and promotion decisions to ensure that this kind of discrimination won't happen again, especially dealing with people who are deaf and the reasonable accommodations that are needed for them, including the provision of sign language interpreters. And they've agreed to pay $45,000 in damages to the complainant. The complainant chose to stay with the job that she had in L.A. and not seek employment in Ventura County. So I think you can see that's the sort of tip of the iceberg, sort of a rushed way through. We're incredibly busy on a variety of fronts, and it's been a very exciting time at the department to fulfill really our objective of robustly enforcing the Americans with Disabilities Act. So with that, we'll turn this over to Sharon.
Thank you very much, John. I always learned so much about what's going on at Justice by participating in this session. And welcome to everybody out there. And this is an exciting time, being the 20th anniversary of the ADA. Like the Department of Justice, the EEOC wants to mark this occasion, and we will do so this Thursday, July 22nd. We are having a program at our headquarters in Washington this Thursday afternoon from 2 to 4. With a lot of the key people who were responsible not only for the enactment of the ADA, but subsequently involved in very key ways with the development of the original ADA regulations and its implementation. So if you are in the Washington, D.C. area, please feel free to come by. If you are not and you are interested, it will be live streamed, and information about the program and who will be participating is on our website, eeoc.gov. What is on everyone's minds these days, quite understandably, is an update on the ADA Amendments Act regulations and when people might expect for them to be issued. And as much as I would love to use the opportunity of this program to tell you specifically when they will be out, unfortunately, I cannot do that. I think, as most people are well aware, last year the EEOC published a proposed regulation. We got well over 650 comments in from the public, from a wide range of employers, disability organizations, labor unions, all kinds of interested parties. Obviously, we have an obligation to go through all those comments very carefully and diligently. One of the things that we have been waiting for in terms of developing the final regulations is to have a full complement of commissioners. If people follow the EEOC closely, you know we are supposed to have a total of 5 commissioners, but for quite a long time we only had 2, and that slowed us down. But this past April and May, we got our 3 additional commissioners, so we now have all 5. And so one of the things that very much they need to look to, and they know this, is to try to draft the final ADA Amendments Act regulations. When that is done, unfortunately, that's not the end of the process, but rather at that time it goes to an agency called the Office of Management and Budget, kind of the gatekeeper for all federal agencies, and they must review all regulations that are proposed, whether as proposed or proposed for final publication. So once the EEOC has approved a draft final regulation, it will go to the Office of Management and Budget, and they can take a couple of months to do a review. It gets reviewed by other federal agencies as well. Then there may be some further changes, and then finally we get to publication. So we are still a bit away, unfortunately, from having a final rule. I advise people to watch the EEOC website, because as soon as we start taking concrete steps in this final effort to get the final rule published, there will be notification on our website, so that's a way to monitor where we are, what progress we are making towards this. But I really am not able to give people at this point a specific date, because I just truly don't know it. So what does that mean, that we don't have a final rule? And often then I am asked, you know, what do people do in the meantime? Well, we do have the statute, and one of the things is that there is a lot of clarity in the statute itself, as people probably saw if they looked at the proposed regulation. There are many things that the regulation will simply repeat, because there's really nothing more to be said. This is one of the reasons that Congress went back to look at the definition of disability, and this time to put in much more detail, was simply to kind of nail down certain issues. So there is a lot that we do know for certain, and that really cannot and will not be changed in a final regulation. So certainly I encourage all people to pay close attention to the statute. Remember, it is on the EEOC website. And in terms of where inevitably there are some issues that are a bit gray that we don't necessarily have all the definitive answers for, to play it safe, then I do refer people to EEOC's proposed regulation. Of course, there will be some changes. I don't think that's giving away anything. Almost no proposed rule ever goes through and doesn't change when it's published for in its final form. So there could well be some changes, but in the meantime, this is out there, and certainly as a guidepost, it's well worth remembering it's there and following it as well. In terms of other things, I can tell you about what's going on here at the EEOC. One of the things we have noticed in the past couple of years is, after a number of years where the ADA charges kind of were flat, that we weren't seeing much difference, the past couple of years there have been significant increases. It's almost now three years ago, in 2007, that year we ended up with almost 18,000 ADA charges. But by 2008, it jumped another 2,000 charges. So we were now inching up towards 20,000 charges. And then last year, 2009, we had a 10% increase, the largest single year increase ever of ADA charges, and we were now starting to approach 22,000 ADA charges. And what was really significant about last year is that in all other categories, Title VII, age discrimination, either the numbers held flat, they were sort of consistent from the year before, or they even went down a little bit. So the only category where we saw an increase was the ADA. And I can leave it to people far smarter than I am to give you an interpretation of why that might be. Some have wondered if the enactment of the ADA Amendments Act may well have created kind of renewed interest and people being better educated. And even though the ADA Amendments Act itself really had not gone into effect, nonetheless, that it was causing people to look around and sort of examine their rights. Of course, it also was timed with the country going into a recession, people far more vulnerable in terms of their jobs and holding on to them. So my guess is when you get these kinds of instances, it's probably a variety of factors. But nonetheless, our ADA charges have been going up. In terms of, and that's good news and bad news perhaps, but to us it's a concern because, as again, most people probably know, EEOC has been confronted these past few years with a growing backlog of cases. And this has been one of the things in this administration that has gotten a lot of scrutiny. We have undergone significant hiring in our local offices because that's where we need the staff. We need them on those front lines when people are filing the charges. We have not had sufficient staff to do the investigations necessary, to do them as quickly as we would like to do them. So obviously it takes a while. Our backlog has reached 86,000 cases. We're starting to chip away at that, but that's not the kind of number where you can get it down in just a couple of months. So that's going to take us a while, but that's one of the commitments of the current leadership is to do much better, to have more staff out there, and to be working much more effectively and efficiently. In terms of the Commission's focus on ADA issues, where we are heading, even before we get the final ADA amendments regulations, the Commission believes that for us, where the focus so much these past few years has been on the definition of disability, that we are going to start moving away from that. Once we have the final regulations out, it is our expectation that there will be far more clarity about who is covered and who is not, and that the focus in our investigations and certainly the focus in litigation is going to shift away from this intense focus on whether a particular person meets the definition of disability, and instead we'll be looking at other issues. In fact, what everybody thought the ADA initially was going to do when it came to employment. And so for ourselves doing investigations, and I think particularly as court cases start to develop, we really see far greater focus on the substantive issues, on really looking at whether discrimination has occurred, how you determine that, and there are specific areas, and EEOC really hopes in a number of ways to play a part in increasing this focus, starting with qualification standards. This is an issue that EEOC has begun looking at much more closely, the whole subject of qualification standards for jobs. This is a very broad term. It encompasses all kinds of standards and requirements and tests, almost anything one can think of for any given job, whether it's educational requirements, work experience requirements, certain kinds of skills that one must have, the ability to speak a foreign language, for example, or certain computer skills, certain what's often called soft skills where you have to be able to work well with people or work well under pressure, those kinds of requirements. Medical standards, there are jobs that have set medical standards. All of these fall under the heading of qualification standards. And in the first 20 years of ADA enforcement in terms of employment, relatively little has been spotlighted on this, to us, very key issue. And so EEOC has started examining those issues far more closely because we think it's time that there be much more of a spotlight on this key part of the ADA. We also think that despite all the efforts that, we have undertaken regarding reasonable accommodation and undue hardship, and certainly it's gotten attention in the courts, we think it's going to get even more attention in the next 5 to 10 years, that one of the results of the ADA Amendments Act, the broadening of coverage, just has to be that you will have more people eligible for reasonable accommodations, and that means more people who will be requesting them and should be getting them. And we think that there are a lot of issues that have really only, we've kind of only skimmed the surface of it, that have not gotten quite the intense look that we're expecting. So this is another huge area that we want to be prepared for, and that we think is going to be key. Direct threat, the safety and health standards regarding people with disabilities. This is another area that we think will come up more frequently, that there will be a bigger issue and there'll be more of an examination of what constitutes a direct threat, how big a risk, what kinds of harms, how much harm, the level and severity of harm there has to be to qualify as a direct threat. And then the overlap with reasonable accommodation, to what extent can reasonable accommodation help bring down that very high level of risk. The other area that we think is going to get more attention in the coming years, disability-related inquiries and medical examinations, particularly as they concern employees. We certainly think there'll be perhaps some more cases involving job applicants, but we think that the bigger area where this could come up are current employees. And so again, although EEOC, I hope everybody is familiar with our publications on these two issues, this is yet another area that we think are going to get far greater focus. So I think we've got kind of a next generation of issues that hopefully for EEOC, for the courts, for all of you listening in, it won't be so much about the disability anymore. Certainly after we get past the initial implementation of the regulation, that we'll start moving into this next generation of issues. And I think that's what everybody is kind of waiting for, not least Congress wanting to see that's the direction that the ADA is heading. So, with that, I think we can probably open it up now for people's questions.
All right, thanks, Sharon. We've lost Robin, so I'm taking over for her. Heather, if you would come back on and give instructions on how folks can ask questions and get in the queue,
sure.
Please.
And Robin is reconnected.
Okay. Go ahead and give instructions, please.
No problem. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one.
And while we're waiting for those questions to come in, John, I have one for you that was submitted online. I just wanted a clarification on the first thing that you had mentioned about the notice of rulemaking in the four areas of accessible websites, medical equipment, and 911 centers and new technologies. And just for clarification, that's new rulemaking aside from what is taking place with the pending Title II and Title III regulations, correct? Did we lose John?
Heather, sorry, I'm sorry. Oh, I have the mute button on and I didn't take it off.
You gave an eloquent answer that we didn't get to hear.
Yeah, no, that's correct. If we are successful in completing all of these, and when we are, we will have a total of 6 regulations, the 2 final regulations and the 4 new ANPRMs.
Okay. Excellent. Heather, can we go to our first question, please? And just a quick reminder, if folks are using a speakerphone, it's best if you pick up the handset if possible. If not, make sure the speaker is closest to the phone so everyone can hear the question. So, Heather, can we have our first question, please?
Yes, our first question comes from Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
Hi, Peter. Hi, John, Sharon. My question is for John. As much as you can, there, on the 2 cases especially that you talked about, the attorney who refused the service animal and the agency that refused the interpreter for people who are deaf, I figure there has to be more to the story than this. You know, it seems like anyone with a basic understanding of the ADA would be aware of these as problems. Is there more to the story, or were they just not informed? Was this just a rogue individual? What's the rationale here?
I wish I could say there was more to the story and that the people were not the type of people who would be well informed. The lawyer was a lawyer's office, and frankly, he was afraid. He said he had installed new carpeting, and he didn't want the dog to soil his carpeting. And in the city of Ventura, the Ventura County, they just looked at it. She had a very positive interview at first, and then when people higher up in the county realized that they would need to, at least for part of her job, provide sign language interpreting services, they decided, number one, that she wasn't qualified then for the job, and that, number two, they didn't have an obligation to spend money for that sort of thing. So they were more sort of bread and butter, everyday kind of issues. And we see lots of these. I don't think that we thought of these as unusual in that regard. They were unusual in that especially in the lawyer's case, we had to litigate to the extent that we did, and the same thing with Ventura County, both of them. And remember, the Ventura County one had gone through an investigation at EEOC and an attempt to conciliate it at EEOC before it came to our agency, and both of them were somewhat, you know, some of our litigation ends pretty quickly. Both of these were more protracted.
To me, that's just incredibly scary. That means that we've got to go through these extraordinary efforts to try and, you know, remove these barriers. Do you have any guidance for those folks that are out there on the front line to try and avoid the going to the Department of Justice?
Well, the reason we try to publicize these as much as possible is to have them out there for people to understand. The law firm one got a lot of press in the legal press, in a variety of places, and so I think it served to educate a lot of law firms if they weren't thinking about that already. But I would say we will continue to do outreach in those areas, and you can, you know, these entities had to pay money in compensatory damages to these people, and I think that you can say to entities that are doing this, you don't need to go down that road. There are ways to do this without incurring that. But I think we just have a continuing job to do. I think the DIBTACs do a great job of trying to get the word out about what entities' obligations are. I think once we get our regulations out, there will be probably more publicity about some of these kinds of issues, and I hope we'll just keep at it.
If I can just interject, I know the question was directed to John, but just to kind of reinforce and reiterate what he's saying, that, you know, it's always kind of you take two steps forward and one step back. And from an EEOC perspective, we still seek the kinds of cases that you wish we did not see, that you would like to think 20 years on this would be completely settled, and it's not. And I'm thinking just in the past month, some cases that we settled, we had a case against Petco, the big pet company, Petco, $145,000 to settle a case in which they failed to provide reasonable accommodation to a deaf pet groomer. It was a woman who had been doing pet grooming for, I think, like 30 years, many, many years, quite expert at it. And when she was hired, I mean, no surprise, she's deaf, and one of the things that she asked for assistance with was scheduling clients. And, you know, for any of us who've been doing this work for any length of time, there would have been a number of ways that could have been handled to deal with this communication issue. And Petco said all the right things when they hired her, and then people dropped the ball. And basically what happened is she wasn't getting scheduled. And, in fact, staff on the phone were telling people, oh, she no longer works there, when she clearly did. And so what should have been a pretty routine, easy thing to handle was not. Then we recently settled another case for $100,000, a national staffing firm, you know, these firms that place people in various companies. And they hired a blind person to do recruiting, and again, somebody with lots and lots of experience. And when the owner realized that a blind person had been hired, this person already had started, owner fired the person because they're blind. And so you have these sort of egregious, outrageous examples, and I think it's a reminder that we're not where we need to be yet. I think part of it is we are moving forward. It is not all bad news for sure. There are lots of things that are going right, but there are a lot of employers for, you know, all kinds of reasons. People who, you know, things get a lot of publicity when they first come out and for the first few years, and then it trails off. And I think, remember, that with the employment area especially, where so much of the focus went to did a person have a disability and people were found not to, and that was the end of the case, I think for at least some employers a mindset started to develop that, oh, ADA and employment, you know, it's not that big a deal and they don't have to do much. So this is kind of a wake-up call that, oh, yes, they do. And so EEOC tries in the litigation it brings is sort of a mix of, you can call them bread and butter cases, these kinds of things, but also what I talked about earlier, the next generation, that you want to sort of get into some new areas as well, that we want to nail down that there are some issues beyond something as obvious as the two kinds of cases we have. But I think that anybody working in this field just cannot sort of say in the first 20 years of ADA, we've gone past all of this. Unfortunately, we haven't yet.
Yeah. And with the release of the Title II and Title III regulations and eventually the new EEOC regulations, a great opportunity for education outreach, and hopefully there'll be a lot of publicity about those regulations to raise public awareness. Heather, can we have our next question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from Alan Goldstein. Your line is open.
Hi. I want to thank you both. It's been a very interesting session, and I'm really glad about all the issues that both agencies are looking into. My question's for Sharon. I'm with Equip for Equality, the Illinois Protection and Advocacy Agency, and I'm really glad to hear you're looking in, one, to qualified issues in employment, as well as the testing. But one issue we see a lot is pre-employment testing, which I think you said you were going to focus more on the testing of employees. Because the main case on it is the Carriker versus Rent-A-Center case that our agency wrote an amicus brief on. Mm-hmm. And the Seventh Circuit found that the Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory was a medical exam that could not be given pre-employment. What we're seeing now is a lot of places, whether it's bagging groceries in Jewel or working at a big box store, they have what's called a pre-employment application, and it's a 20-page questionnaire which contains questions seemingly lifted from the MMPI, you know, other people seem happier than I do, or I count things that are not important. Plus, the language is really complex, and it seems like these tests can not only discriminate against people with mental health issues, but people with cognitive disabilities from different ethnic or cultural backgrounds, with people with marginal English skills. Mm-hmm. So we see these pre-employment testing issues as being big, and they're often hard cases to bring because it's hard to prove why someone wasn't hired. So I was just wondering or hoping if the EEOC might look at some of those issues too, because a lot of big companies are using these tests and they've become standardized. And I think they really can discriminate against a wide range of people, even beyond various disability issues.
Well, you're certainly right. First of all, I thank you for your comment and your question rolled into one. And you're right that it is something that EEOC has noticed, that a lot of jobs that in years past, fairly kind of standard and not too involved in terms of the hiring process, have gotten far more, far longer, and these kinds of sophisticated instruments that you are describing are being used. And the overlap that you're right, it may not be simply people with disabilities who might get caught up in them or tripped up by them. In other words, they're not really measuring someone's ability to do the job. It's more their ability to get through this hiring process. But also there can be language barriers or other things. So, yes, this is one of the areas that we are looking at as well. It's not necessarily medically focused, and that's what I was really talking about in terms of one of the big areas we're focusing on. But in terms of qualification standards, that these kinds of 20-page applications and the kinds of questions coming up, it is something we are focused on.
All righty. Heather, can we have our next question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from Curtis Motoyama. Your line is open.
This question is for John. This is Mona Higa. I guess the question I have is, if there's a conflict between something like the ADAG and a local building code, which takes precedence? Because sometimes with the local building code, the reason for compliance they're citing is life safety. And in order to comply with that, though, it might mean that you're not in compliance with something in the ADAG.
I guess you're talking to a federal official, so a federal official is going to point out that a federal law would trump a conflicting state law in this area. So I think that would be the case. But if my suggestion would be if something like that arises to involve us, either by calling the ADA information line or sending us an email to see if we can address the issue, because it may have come up in other localities or other places, and also to see if there's some way that you can deal correctly with both, that we can try to marry through equivalent facilitation or some other some issue. It would depend upon the nature of the conflict.
Okay, thank you.
I thank you for your question. Heather, our next question, please.
Yes, once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one. I'm not showing further questions at this time.
No additional questions at this time.
But once again, if you do have a question or a comment, please press star, then one.
This is Robin, and yeah, I just question for you in regards to the whole process that you're going through with this new proposed potential NPRM. Given the fact that the big debate has been about things like the ADA not having internet specifically in it, and some of these things, will that be a challenge in regards to writing rules and regs that there's not explicit language? I know your interpretation is that that's inclusive of what is currently in the ADA. But do you anticipate any of the things that you're looking at as additional would have any kind of a problematic because they're not actually in the statute mentioned specifically in the statute?
Well, it's there's been some litigation already, and it's gone in different directions. I think we believe that our interpretation of both Titles II and Titles III, that the language there encompasses what are the websites that provide basic services that are the types covered by Title III and by Title II. I think we feel very strongly that we have very strong and solid legal support. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if we got comments that the ADA didn't apply, or even if we provide take steps to do that, that there may be those who will disagree with that and file a lawsuit on the subject. Although I think as we see the nature of technology in our society, we see how significant the use of web services, the use of kiosks, the use of a variety of devices and approaches have just become so important in everyday living that when you compare that with the scope of the ADA, I think there will be a basis for doing that. But I certainly would not be surprised if there are challenges in that area and people who disagree with our approach or interpretation. I mean, the reason we are doing this as an advance, or will be, I hope, doing this as an advance notice of proposed rulemaking is to air out all of these issues, to air out techniques that are available, what standards should be available, what are the limitations similar to the way the ADA operates and other limitations on its coverage, how do they work in this area. And so we expect a very lively discussion with a lot of comments.
Great. And I have an email that came in, somebody sent in, that wanted to know from Sharon, what's the EEOC's take on any of the decisions that have been handed down so far by some of the district circuit courts on applying the ADA Amendments Act, and has the EEOC engaged in any technical assistance with the courts or amicus briefs or anything of that nature on any cases at all to date in the absence of your regulations at this point?
EEOC is monitoring court decisions. We monitor them anyway, but obviously we are most interested as we start seeing the first decisions involving the ADA Amendments Act. So far we only have a handful of cases that have come out. Most of the cases have not been so much looking at the definition of disability, but establishing that the statute is not retroactive, that it will not apply to situations that arose before the enactment date of January 1, 2009. But we do have a handful of district court cases that have involved situations that arose after the enactment date and therefore are applying the ADA Amendments Act. These are very, very early cases. EEOC has not been involved with them, but clearly we are looking at the rationale courts are using as they do their analysis, and obviously taking that into account as we look at the regulation as well. But we have very few of them to date.
Sharon, another question that was submitted electronically along the same lines. This has to do with internal workings at EEOC and how your investigation staff is investigating charges that have been filed, charging disability discrimination that has taken place since January 1st, 2009, and what the staff is using as a guideline for those investigations.
For any situation that arose on or after January 1st, 2009, EEOC investigators are using the proposed regulation. And the reason for that is that the proposed regulation was approved by the commissioners, meaning it represents current commission policy. It's not the law at this point because it's still only a proposed rule, but in terms of the internal workings of the EEOC, it is commission policy, and investigators follow commission approved policy. So until such time as the commissioners vote for a final rule, this remains the policy to be used. So anybody who has a case that would be under the ADA Amendments Act, they should be expecting EEOC to follow its proposed rule.
Okay. Let's check, Heather. Do we have any questions by phone at this time?
Yes, we had some questions come in. Our first one comes from Matt Norris. Your line is open.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Susan Klein. I was struck by the 86,000 backlog, Sharon, that you talked about. I realize there's been insufficient staffing. Are there other issues related to such a large backlog, and are there positions that could be taken at the local level to reduce that problem?
Most of it really does become a staffing issue. EEOC is a very labor-intensive organization because most of the work that we do does not occur here at the national headquarters where I work, but it really is out in our field offices across the country. It's people filing charges and our need to process, to investigate them, to reach conclusions, mediations that we conduct there. But overwhelmingly, it's about having bodies on the ground to do this kind of work. And EEOC has gotten an increase in its appropriations the last couple of years. That money has gone almost exclusively to hire new investigators and some new attorneys in our field offices. This kind of backlog does not develop overnight, and nor can we unfortunately eradicate it overnight. But I think we are starting to make strides there. There's also been an attempt to look at ways to better handle cases that come in so that, I mean, some cases that come in, people are upset with their employers. They really have no place else to go. They sort of hear Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and they know they have an employment issue. And by law, we have to take every case that somebody wants to file. We can't just turn someone away. But some of those are not really cases that we can do anything about. It's not about discrimination. But once a case is filed, it's not just about hitting a delete button. It does clog up our system a little bit. So we certainly have some of that in there, and we're trying to see if we can get people who can kind of identify those cases, get them out of the system as quickly as possible so that our investigators really get the cases that they're meant to have. The other thing that we're trying to do is a lot of our people, in addition to doing investigations, also do outreach and technical assistance, and we are trying to take those job tasks as much as possible and have other people like myself who really can step in and, you know, I can do that. I can't go out and do the investigation, but I certainly can be there to answer questions from the public and do other things. So we are looking to see how we can take some of that workload and redistribute it to people who are better able to handle it, and again, make sure our investigators have all the time, as well as resources that they may have lacked, and we're trying to make sure they have sufficient resources. So, you know, I can't tell people that we'll have that number down. And remember, that number is not just ADA. That's all of the cases that we investigate, all the different statutes. Is that, you know, I'm not going to expect it to come down significantly in the first year, but I'm hoping 2-3 years from now that number is going to be much, much smaller.
All right, great. One other question that came in electronically before we get back to the phones came in for both of you. Ask this to John first. It's regarding technical assistance materials and guidance materials, the, you know, Title II and Title III technical assistance manuals, and what kind of timeline you have for getting those updated technical assistance documents out on ADA.gov and EEOC.gov once new regulations are published.
Yeah, I think we realize that we face a daunting task once the regulation is done. One of the things that the law requires us to do is a small business compliance guide, which we will do within 6 months of the publication of the rule. We also will begin a series of some documents explaining what we're doing, but also I think we will begin a process of revising really just about all of our technical assistance materials, and keep in mind once the EEOC finishes its ADA Amendments Act regulations, we are going to go through a similar process, which will require us to deal with further changes. But I think we're very much aware of the need that we will have to update our TA materials, as well as to deal with, I mean, I don't want people to lose focus that one of the things that the new regs will be doing is creating guidance. Now, it's been there from the Access Board since 2004, so it's not so new to many of you, but we are going to have guidance on a variety of recreational facilities, from parks and playgrounds and golf courses and exercise facilities and fishing piers and boating facilities and saunas, steam rooms, swimming pools, and also we'll have new standards for courthouses and jails and detention facilities. So in addition to just updating the materials we have, I think we have work to do in creating guidance in some of those additional areas.
And from an EEOC perspective, we, as you may well know, if you go onto our website, all of our publications have notices on them about the ADA Amendments Act. Only two of them we could kind of say there's no change, or the changes were so slight they've been made to them, and that's clearly indicated. But we are well aware of all of our existing publications that will need to be updated once we have a final rule. And clearly EEOC will start that process before the final rule is published. When we feel pretty confident we know what it's going to look like, we are basically set to start making those changes so that as quickly as possible we can update those documents. And as they are updated, the notices will change. The notices will indicate that they have been updated. But we have gone through not just the publications. We know exactly where in each publication we are going to have to be making changes so that we can do this as quickly and efficiently as possible. But I wouldn't hesitate. You know, I hesitate. I can't give you an exact timetable for this. But we hope to do that very, very quickly once we have a final rule out.
Excellent. And when final rules are published from both EEOC and DOJ, will those be available on ada.gov and eeoc.gov respectively?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Excellent. All right, Heather, can we have our next question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from Teresita Gonzalez. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. Hi. Thank you for your presentation. It's very, very informative. The question I have actually doesn't have to do with employment, so to speak, but also in everyday life. One of the things that came to mind, I noticed that the entertainment industry, the theaters and such, do not offer closed caption for the hard of hearing or the deaf. Do you see in the future that this is going to be something, a trend that may change?
I guess I can take that. I think it's something very much on our, if I can use the pun, screen. We certainly have worked with, you know, some in the entertainment industry, not movie theaters directly, but like Walt Disney World and other places like that, to ensure that video presentations that they have are available in a caption format. One of the ANPRMs that I was talking about addresses the movie industry and the requirement to have movies both captioned and to have a video description of them for people who are blind. And there are a couple issues affecting this industry. I mean, they're in the process of a change to a digital format, and that has some implication for this. And there's changing technology for the ability of the kinds of devices that would allow closed captioning to be used. And so I see this very much as an important issue in the next couple of years that we will be working on to try to get to a point where people who are deaf or hard of hearing and people who are blind will be able to enjoy one of America's major industries and most prolific industries and to be able to enjoy the product that is offered.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
right, thank you for your question. Heather, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from James Elks. Your line is open.
Thank you. I guess this goes to DOJ. The Access Board has just completed their ANPRM on the first round of Section 508. If you folks are going to do similar work that extends to other sectors, other communities, is it going to be likely done in harmonization, or is it going to be separate and apart from the existing work of the Access Board on 508?
It's a good question. We are very much in the age of harmonization and not duplicating the effort or the expertise that the Access Board has developed on Section 508 standards. I mean, some of the issues we're considering as we're looking at this is not only that, but the WC3 standards and what are the appropriate ways for the federal government to require in terms of not just areas covered by 508, but the areas covered by the ADA or areas covered by the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504, for example. But I think we're very much of a mind of looking to what other entities have done rather than creating a new standard that might be in conflict. But we're early in that process, and those are the kinds of questions we're going to try to elicit guidance from when we are able to issue these proposed rules.
Okay, two other quick questions. I know since the Access Board has been involved in the ADA, it's always, for the most part, them issuing guidelines, and then DOJ and DOT wind up issuing the standards. I mean, obviously, it's a period of time that is long and arduous for everyone, considering the ADA guidelines now in finalizing form were issued in 2004. Is there any likelihood that a more, again, harmonized or combined process where if the Access Board is working on revising guidelines simultaneously, the NPRMs are going out from the respective partners in order to shorten the process?
Well, I think I can say that those of us in the federal government share the concern with the duplication and length of time that the process takes. Now, the statute does provide this two-step process, but I think we are hoping that the next set of issues that the Access Board is working on under the ADA are public rights-of-way guidelines, and I think we are hoping that we can follow something close to the scenario that you're suggesting as we proceed with those so that it is a much more compact period of time, not as drawn out, not as difficult for everyone, and I think much more efficient in terms of not having people comment innumerable times. We also, one of the things that we have to do that is very time-consuming is if regulations are going to be costly, develop what is called a regulatory impact analysis, which is sort of a cost-benefit analysis. And if we do things closer together, we may be able to do those jointly. And so I think we will take to heart not only your comments, but our view of the experience we've had over the past 10 years at trying to get these the changes to the ADA done. So I think we have learned what not to do. Now we can see if we can get ourselves to work much more in concert, and if not simultaneously, pretty close to simultaneously.
One quick final question. Sorry, I have
okay.
Three of them. I know that the Access Board started the guidelines for passenger vessels in 1998. It's now 12 years later. There's been all kinds of NPRMs republishing, more issues being brought up. Do you foresee, and perhaps this is a personal question, any light at the end of the tunnel that perhaps by the 25th anniversary we will have a final set of concrete, no pun intended, to sink the ships, standards for passenger vessels?
But let me say this. I am in no position to be in the prognostication position, because if I counted up the number of times I was wrong about predicting when my own regulations would come out, you would pay no attention to anything I would be saying. Let me just say that there is a lot of activity going on both at the Department of Transportation, at the Access Board, and at the Department of Justice on passenger vessels. We are involved heavily in that, and there will be action, I hope, on a faster time frame than your five-year period.
But Janet Blizzard might actually see them before she retires.
You never can tell.
Thank you so much.
All right. Before we go to our next question by phone, Janet, question came in, someone asking that in the past you had stated that the Department of Justice had seen little in the way of complaints being filed by individuals with intellectual disabilities, and the questioner wanted to know whether that's something that has changed or you still see a very very little in terms of complaints.
We really, in terms of the nature of the complaints we get, we still see very few that raise intellectual disabilities issues, cognitive disability issues. I think that one of the things that I keep talking to people about, especially with the type of injuries that are occurring in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with the large number of service members who are returning with traumatic brain injury and other related conditions, that I expect we should be prepared for more and doing more about that, but we still don't see the volume of those issues. Now, as we have stepped up our Olmstead work, we are certainly doing issues involving not only people with mental health conditions, but people with developmental disabilities and other disabilities in that work. But that really isn't complaint-driven in the same sense of the sort of day-to-day complaints that we get from people around the country. So I think we are still at a deficit in terms of getting those kinds of complaints.
All right, thanks. Heather, do we have another question, please?
Yes, our next question comes from Kathy Gibbs. Your line is open.
Hi, actually, it's Rachel Tannenhaus from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and actually formerly of the DOJ. So hi, John.
Hi.
Brody says hi, too. So I actually have I've noticed that the DOJ has come out with some opinions with regard to electronic textbooks and specifically e-book readers and mm-hmm. such used by universities and students, and their inaccessibility to folks who are blind, partly due to the inaccessibility, partly due to some of the publishers not being willing to make their media accessible. And so, first of all, I appreciate that, but second of all, my question is there any kind of ongoing work partnership going on between the DOJ and the Department of Education to work on that sort of thing? I'm not even sure whose role would be what in there. Is there any kind of outreach to either the manufacturers or to the publishers to try to make it so that this wouldn't be an issue? That kind of thing. I'm just wondering how that's progressing, because I know certainly in the community of folks who are blind or have other impairments, and among students, it's a huge issue.
Right. I think one thing you can see from the joint letter that I mentioned that followed those settlement agreements that we did, I mean, we're very much interested in partnering. I think that's one of the hallmarks of the Obama administration. Agencies should be breaking down the silos between them and working together. And so we have been reaching out and working with our colleagues at the Department of Education on these issues. And part of the problem that we have in terms of dealing with some of these issues is that some of the issues are created by the manufacturers, and we don't have a direct relationship with them, and so our relationship with them is indirect, which doesn't mean we can't reach out to them with the problems that are there. It probably means they don't spend a lot of time listening to us because we have no authority over them. But what has happened even with the Kindle DX, Once we started telling universities basically that it was a violation of the ADA to use the Kindle DX, Amazon went back and said pretty quickly that they were going to redesign it so that the menus and would become usable by people who were blind or had low vision. So I think by drying up the market that they had for their product, it was an indirect way of bringing about change. And I think we see this issue across technology. You know, technology has been a driving force under the ADA for providing accessibility. And we think we want to ensure that that trend continues and that as manufacturers and inventors and other people come up with new solutions and new ideas, that they consider issues of people with disability. And so we will be working with them to do that. The issue is coming up in testing and making sure testing products are accessible in a wide range of ways, and so we will continue. It is very much an issue for the future of the ADA, and our goal really is simply to ensure that people with disabilities aren't left behind as we proceed along with the technological revolution.
Heather, can we get one last question before we get to the bottom of the hour?
Yes, our last question is a follow-up from Curtis Motoyami's line. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thank you for taking our question. I'm sorry we're out in Hawaii, so it's morning here. But my question has to do with housing and those of us that deal with residential towers and condo associations and service pets. You know, problems with getting service pets in because, say, the condo association, or not service pets, but service dogs because the condo association says no pets, and then dealing with boards of directors, and how also do you all work with, I guess, HUD perhaps on some of these issues?
Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, for one of the clearest areas, the Fair Housing Act, if it's the type of housing that it's multifamily housing that would be that the Fair Housing Act disability provisions would apply to, HUD would has a long tradition, both under 504 and under the Fair Housing Act, for requiring service animals and for the Fair Housing Act purposes, emotional support animals in housing. So that is an issue. We have worked with them on that issue. We have part of the Justice Department does housing discrimination, not my section in particular, but I think it's pretty clear what requires there. And I'm hopeful that there'll be more guidance in the final ADA regs on all of those issues that you are raising.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for your question. And as always, Sharon and John, we thank you for your time. You've been great friends to the ADA National Network and the assistance that you provide to us. Just a quick reminder of the final two audio conference sessions in the 2009-2010 series on August the 17th, we will have a session entitled ADA and after-school and daycare centers accommodating children with disabilities. And then our final session will be September 21st, touching on something that John talked about during his presentation, corrections in the ADA, balancing the rights of people with disabilities while incarcerated. You can get additional information about those upcoming sessions by visiting the audio conference website, www.ada-audio.org, or by calling 877-232-1990. If you were unable to get your question answered today, you can reach your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. And as always, today's session will be archived in approximately 2 weeks' time, 10 business days. The session will be archived to the ADA audio conference website, both a text transcript and an audio archive. So once again, thank you very much to Sharon Rennert and John Wodich, our speakers today. Everyone have a great day, and we look forward to you joining us in August. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect.